Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, who assesses corporate media's lack of critical coverage of the recently concluded political party nominating conventions. John Sellers, director of the Ruckus Society, which trains activists in nonviolent direct action techniques, who talks about his arrest during the GOP nominating convention in Philadelphia, where he was held on $1 million bond. And Alan Minsky, general coordinator of the Los Angeles Independent Media Center, who discusses the philosophy behind the growing number of centers established to bypass corporate media spin since last winter's protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Colombian labor leader Luis Velasquez lives in constant danger. He must move his home regularly to keep ahead of political assassins. At the moment, Colombia is considered to be the most dangerous place on earth in which to be a trade union activist. According to the news magazine In These Times, over 3,000 union activists have been killed in Colombia since 1985, with nearly 100 unionists killed this year by gunmen and bombers. The president of the main labor federation, the CUT, travels in an armored car with three bodyguards. But Velasquez, the federation's director of labor affairs, has no bodyguards. He must survive by using his wits. However, there is more than political violence for unions to contend with. Colombia's economy is mired in a deep recession and under intense pressure from the International Monetary Fund to open markets and break union contracts. On a speaking tour in the U.S., Velasquez stated, "We have felt the impact of globalization in a big way. The entire arsenal of repression was unleashed against the labor movement." In recent years, union membership roles shrank as union contracts were axed in favor of employee-mandated collective pacts and the Colombian government slashed social programs. Today, three-quarters of workers only make the minimum wage of $135 a month. Meanwhile, Colombian trade unions are weary of the new U.S.-funded war on drugs and leftist rebels. To create peace, Velasquez says, a plan must be in place to fight the country's chronic poverty. The labor leader says, "The war in Colombia has to be seen as a class conflict. If we talk about real peace, we have to talk about social justice. Peace in an abstract way does not exist." In his long-awaited acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, Vice President Al Gore fired up his campaign by promising to fight for working families and take on the HMOs and big drug companies. But behind all the overheated rhetoric stands a much more conservative Al Gore, who follows the economic advice of free market backers like Treasury Secretary Larry Summers and former Clinton aide Robert Rubin, now chairman of Citigroup. In this election, Gore's top economic priority is debt reduction. The centrist Democrat has gone as far as to call for the termination of all federal debt. With a projected $3.4 trillion federal surplus over the next decade, Gore is sticking to his new Democrat formula: ignore traditional social programs and rely on Wall Street and the new economy to boost prosperity. According to The Nation magazine, Gore's economic program is very clear. Financial capital comes first, the people will benefit later. This spring, Gore's anti-debt rhetoric went so far as to pledge to defend the surplus in any future recession. But critics charge that this would worsen a recession. And during a downturn, most economists agree that government should be spending more money to kickstart the economy. Some progressive analysts say the current federal surplus is creating a drag on the U.S. economy. Growth is slowing because of rising interest rates, and the savings rate has fallen to zero. It is a situation similar to that in Japan in the late 1980s, when the economy crashed after years of financial speculation. Today, Japan is still struggling. But Al Gore and his free market advisers appear to be headed down the same road by relying on Wall Street to run the economy. The troubling wave of violent acts by teenagers is increasing the call by many politicians to get tough on juvenile crime. After the murder of a Florida schoolteacher by a 13-year-old student this spring, Alabama Governor Don Siegelman quipped, "Adult crime means adult time." But recent research by criminologists found that sending juvenile offenders to adult jails only leads to more violent crime in the future. According to the Boston Globe, Pending legislation in Congress would make it much easier to transfer juvenile cases to adult court. Not only would chronic teen offenders be forced into adult court, but first-time drug offenders could face the full force of the criminal justice system. In addition, the proposal gives prosecutors the power to decide if a juvenile should be charged as an adult. Critics say this important power should be left with judges. Northeastern University criminologists Jennifer Balboni and James Allen Fox argue that most wayward juveniles abandon criminal activity by their early 20s. So locking up juveniles in adult prisons is ineffective and amounts to overkill. Criminal justice experts claim that community-based programs are more effective in sanctioning juvenile offenders and giving teens the tools to lead productive lives. These programs also forced teenage offenders to face the people they victimized, something that would never happen if juvenile offenders were locked away in adult prisons. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
The two major party conventions, financed by millions of dollars from America's largest corporations, are finally over. Receiving less television airtime and fewer viewers than previous conventions, these tightly scripted events have in recent years been transformed into virtual infomercials, rather than the arena for heated political debates they used to be. Both parties did their best to rush toward the political center, with the Republicans emphasizing George W. Bush's message of compassionate conservatism with their illusion of inclusion on stage, and Al Gore's selection of Joseph Lieberman as his vice presidential candidate, one of the most conservative Democrats in the U.S. Senate. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, who assesses the Republican and Democratic Party nominating conventions and corporate media's lack of critical coverage of these political extravaganzas.
Unfortunately, the mass media tended to evaluate those conventions the way a theater reviewer would evaluate a performance on Broadway. You know, it's about production values. And it takes a leap of imagination when immersed in that milieu to remember that we're not talking about how well a convention is staged or how folksy or connecting the rhetoric may be for a television audience. It's supposed to be about something called democracy, which is almost a foreign concept these days in terms of these conventions. So I'm afraid that not much information came across, but a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Now, when we look at the selection of vice presidential candidates for both the GOP and the Democrats, certainly that tells a story in and of itself as to, who these two major political parties are trying to appeal to. So we have, on the one hand, the GOP and George W. Bush selecting Dick Cheney, former Secretary of Defense, the guy who voted against the release of Nelson Mandela and a whole bunch of other very hard-to-explain votes. And then with the Democrats, you got Connecticut's own Senator Joseph Lieberman, who is viewed as one of the more conservative Democrats. What can you tell us about these selections and what they tell us about these two center-right political parties?
Well, they tell us about these political parties that they're very much part of what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. And these selections also tell us a lot about the mass media that cover these parties, because both the Cheney and Lieberman nominations were greeted with a great deal of acclaim, applause, and praise from the mass media, from the what has been called the punditocracy. And, you know, Scott, when you step back a little bit and you think about, now, why was Dick Cheney accorded so much acclaim when his nomination was announced? We were told that he was a grown-up, whatever that means, that he had the experience that proved beyond a doubt. As a matter of fact, there were pundits who said, nobody can doubt that Dick Cheney is qualified to be president. Why did they say that? Because he was Secretary of Defense and presided over the Gulf War. And when you're involved in a war, that's considered to be prima facie evidence that you are definitely qualified to be president. When it came to Lieberman, here's a guy Well, let me put it this way. Last Wednesday morning at a press briefing in Los Angeles, I asked somebody from the Democratic National Committee for examples of where Senator Lieberman has ever crossed the agendas of Wall Street on any major issue, where he has ever taken a position that Wall Street was unhappy with. And this person from the Democratic National Committee could not come up with a single example. And I think that tells you a lot about who the vice presidential nominee for the Democrats is and what he stands for.
Why do you think it is that the media goes so soft on these two vice presidential candidates?
Well, it's considered by most news media to be a moral compass if you, for instance, cause the death of 5,000 Iraqi children every month. Senator Lieberman is very strongly in favor of the U.S.-led sanctions on Iraq, killing several thousand kids a month. But according to the news media, you know, that's a moral stance in a positive way. So here, you know, if the guy postures against obscenities, sexual allusions in Hollywood movies or musical recordings, that makes him moral. But if he leads the drive to slaughter Iraqi children, in effect, that also somehow makes him moral. So that tells you a lot about who's making those assessments for the rest of us through the mass media.
Now, the pundits in the news media generally say that the selection of Lieberman was a brilliant choice because in order to win, the Gore ticket needs to reach out to middle America, reach out to the center, to the right. The way I read the media, this is sort of accepted as the gospel truth, that people in general in the United States are well to the right of even Al Gore, the centrist second party in the Clinton-Gore administration.
Well, I think part of it is the notion that one can take for granted one's base, and yet the Nader campaign has shown Gore that he can't quite do that. I think part of the purpose, not the only reason, but the part of the purpose of the language of last Thursday night's acceptance speech was to try to pull in some of the voters who were leaning towards Ralph Nader. And if Gore can do that and also make enough centrist noise to pull in some of the so-called independent or centrist voters, then he figures he has a chance to win. I think, meanwhile, there are the realities that there's so much poverty in our own society, let alone elsewhere in the world, that is really off the media map and off the two-party system map. The fact is that there's no debate inside either party right now. The delegates in Philadelphia and Los Angeles were afraid to talk to journalists about anything approaching politics. They all had their line down. They knew that they were supposed to simply give praise to the nominee. And so you had essentially a stultifying atmosphere, and that lack of debate was replicated in the media. So unless we're going to stir this thing up, we're going to continue to have this rightward trend in the Democratic Party, and we're not going to have any possibility to raise fundamental questions about who controls the political economy and therefore the political system of the country. And right now, it is big money.
That was syndicated columnist Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon's weekly Media Beat column can be found on the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting website at www.fair.org. Thousands of activists took to the streets during the major party nominating conventions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles during the first part of August to focus attention on critical issues that they say neither the Republican or Democratic parties have seriously addressed. Both parties, protesters say, have been bought and paid for by the same set of giant transnational corporations undermining democracy. While engaging in legal demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience, hundreds of protesters were arrested by police in both cities. Civil liberties lawyers, alarmed at what they describe as law enforcement's overreaction to dissent this summer, have criticized police surveillance, harassment, and preemptive strikes against organizers. They also cite instances of police brutality and excessively high bail set for those arrested. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Sellers, director of the California-based Ruckus Society, which trains activists in nonviolent direct action techniques. Sellers talks about his arrest during the GOP convention in Philadelphia while he was accused of being a facilitator of violence and mayhem and held on $1 million bond, later reduced to $100,000.
The biggest contribution that we made to the Republican National Convention protests was a camp that we did about 6 weeks before the DNC even met in Philadelphia. We did a training camp where, you know, it was very open and transparent kind of training. We invited the press to it. We had nothing to hide. You know, it was all about nonviolent direct action. And I was up in Philadelphia just having finished a little summer vacation with my parents down in the Outer Banks and had gotten a ride back up into Philly with them and spent, you know, the time during the Republican National Convention just, you know, kind of giving my moral support to folks and not doing much else. And so it was really shocking to be yanked off the streets on the 2nd of August, I believe. I was just walking down JFK Boulevard with my cell phone, not even using it, just kind of minding my own business, and basically this tactical operation manifested itself around me. I was arrested by, I don't know, three or four lieutenants and a couple of captains, and finally the ranking official that came out was a deputy commissioner with a star on his shoulder. So, you know, it was, you know, kind of an insane situation. These guys have been watching way too many old reruns of SWAT, and they just mobilized, you know, and appeared all around me and then whisked me away in this high-speed car maneuver through the city and took me to the homicide division of the Philadelphia Police Department and interrogated me in an interrogation room for about 4 hours before they even told me what my charges were going to be. And at first, the first charge that I saw when they handed me my receipt for my possessions that they were confiscating was aggravated assault on a police officer. And so until that time, I was being very accommodating and cooperating with them fully and told them that I had nothing to hide and gave them the Ruckus website address. And by the time that, you know, they told me that I was going to be charged with aggravated assault, I was really starting to question, you know, kind of who the man behind the curtain was that was pulling the strings. And I told them that I would no longer be cooperating with them, that, you know, that charge was, you know, flew in the face of everything that I stand for as a nonviolent activist, and that, you know, I was beginning to be very concerned about, you know, what kind of fix was on by that point.
That was an amazing episode in these couple of weeks of protests, both in Philadelphia and Los Angeles. And what do you make of the whole thing in retrospect? It's not over for you. You still have to go to court. But what do you think the objective of the police were in Philadelphia in arresting you, placing these charges on you, the incredibly high bail? Did they want to keep you out of action until after the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles? Was there some kind of a coordination, do you think, with the federal government, the FBI, or other agencies?
I think an amazing activist who cut his teeth in the 60s, Tom Hayden, who was in Chicago in 68, I think put it best when he said that as social movements become more effective, governments become more repressive, and we're starting to see that state sanctioned repression against this anti-corporate globalization movement.
People like Naomi Klein have wrote critically that, you know, we risk burnout if we sort of have one giant protest action after another, that somewhere along the road we have to chart a maybe more thoughtful path in terms of grassroots organizing and issue education at the grassroots. What are some of your thoughts on the various tactics, the various tools that can be used within a growing and dynamic social movement as we're seeing be born across the world now?
I tend to agree with Naomi, actually. I think that we are in danger right now of becoming a tactically led movement of action junkies, because I think that, you know, if we keep moving from mobilization to mobilization, then we stand to begin to, you know, beat a dead horse. And I think that we need to steep and base our success on our strategies and on creating integrated, multifaceted, strategic campaigns that are, you know, that are going to use site-specific, appropriate technology and weave all kinds of different tactics together in very smart ways to achieve measurable goals. And, you know, I think that that's very important for us to use these mobilizations to inspire ourselves and, you know, the people in the United States, and then take that energy and that inspiration back into our individual campaigns, back to our communities, and really put you know, shoulders to the wheel and do the behind the scenes work that really builds movements and builds unity and builds you know, much more powerful and concerted effort that cuts across race and gender and class boundaries, and really builds much more diverse communities of people that are coming together to demand their truth and their justice be heard.
That was John Sellers, director of the Ruckus Society. Contact Ruckus by calling area code 510-848-9565. Or visit their website at www.ruckus.org. While tens of thousands of activists gathered on the streets of Seattle during demonstrations against the World Trade Organization last winter, volunteer independent journalists fanned out across the city to document the action with video cameras, tape recorders, and pen and paper. Unlike their corporate media counterparts, these reporters, some freelance and others working with community media outlets, were free of the restrictions of editors and advertisers who often instinctively shy away from fully covering these protests' militant anti-corporate message. Via an internet website, the Seattle Independent Media Center, and the many new centers that have sprung up afterward, distributes information through video, audio, photography, and text, chronicling the activities and analysis of a growing global social justice movement. The Seattle IMC was wildly successful, attracting more than a million hits from an audience anxious to bypass the corporate media spin. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Alan Minsky, general coordinator of the Los Angeles Independent Media Center, which covered the Democratic Party convention. He discusses the philosophy behind the IMCs, which have been launched in more than a dozen major cities on four continents since last winter's Seattle WTO protests.
Heading into those protests, the organizers of the Seattle Independent Media Center understood that they were dealing with an issue that the World Trade Organization that had largely been kept from public view. I think there was a poll done previous to those events up in Seattle in which only 3% of the public was aware of the United States' relationship to the World Trade Organization in such pacts. So going into those events, the people understood they needed to have a media other than the mainstream media if they were going to get the word out about what the World Trade Organization was and, again, how the United States functioned and how the public was basically excluded from the decision-making. On top of that, anticipating the protests, there's just a long established history of misrepresentation of large public protests within the mainstream media. So that was the sort of second rationale for the sort of organization of the Seattle Independent Media Center. And they developed something that was quite elaborate, primarily for over-the-internet reception by the viewing audience. And it facilitated a media in which the protesters could have their own voice so that they could be heard. And in that way, they could not only elaborate the issues behind the protests, but also have their voices heard in terms of the size of the demonstration and, of course, with what Seattle turned into, the confrontations with the police on the streets.
For listeners who haven't yet visited an IMC website, maybe you could describe for us what kinds of news reporting and the mediums involved that are accessible on the IMC sites.
We have, of course, we work in print, audio, and video. And we have both print articles that anybody can download and read, as well as we have a newswire, which is unique in that anybody can actually enter a story from anywhere in the world simply by going onto our site and clicking on where it says publish. And then those articles that are posted on the newswire, at the end of any of those articles, it says add your comments, so it becomes a de facto chat room. And then a little less interactively are, of course, the audio and the video, where people can click using real audio or real player video.
Since Seattle, IMC, Independent Media Center, websites have been developed all across the United States, Europe, Mexico. I believe Congo has their own IMC site now. How did this grow so quickly? I mean, we're talking about this in the space of 6 or 7 months. This thing has grown exponentially.
I think when you have a good idea, it just spreads. And, you know, there have been prototypes for this type of Internet site previously. A few were in Europe. It's also important to understand that when something takes place in the United States, it's not just another country among many. This is the imperial, both in power in terms of obviously military might, after the fall of the Soviet Union, but also in terms of a global trade. So when something takes place in the United States and something then like the IMC appears along with the protests in Seattle, this is extremely encouraging to especially other countries where there just is a much larger progressive/radical movement. So you see IMCs then are just appearing all over the world. There were 20 of them. And I imagine in the wake of the LA IMC, and I think the successful operation we're running here, we'll see many more appear very soon.
I wanted to ask you how you've strategized at the Independent Media Centers to reach out beyond the already converted, who maybe are even more in need of a different perspective than is delivered by the major news media corporately owned.
You know, that's, of course, maybe the most important question, because I think the majority of people involved in this sort of burgeoning social justice movement, usually a protest movement at these large events, is that the critique that they're putting forth of the society is something that if only people could get wind of, they would concur with for the most part. And also the energy that goes into it, all the sort of free time people put into it, is, signifies... a sense that this can be a movement that can somehow be transformative of the society. And so how do you get the word out to people who don't get this word? Because, I mean, the statistics on how much mass media, which is, of course, almost exclusively corporate-owned media, people receive in this country is staggering. If you add up how much media, corporate-owned media, that the American public consumes each day, it's on the level of about 11 hours a day, and that's the average. And, of course, almost all of that information doesn't really include any kind of social analysis, especially on the realm of the issues that really make up the core of this, of what I would say is a social justice protest movement.
That was Alan Minsky, General Coordinator of the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. Visit IMC websites across the globe by typing in www.indymedia.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.